Okay. I know what you're thinking, guys. Firstly, just want to give a huge props to the community that was kicking my ass because I didn't bloody put any episodes on. I've been going through an awful lot at the moment just with life, just going through life. But anyway, I hope you guys enjoy this. I know it's like 3 months later, but this is episode 6.2 with Kennedy. It's our the rest of it, and again, humble apologies for the long time it took to get this out. I had hard drive issues and had other things as well, but it's here. Enjoy the show, and yeah, hope to catch you on the next episode, and please forgive me. All right, thanks guys. During your tenure with the Tall Ferns, you've had some amazing players, but who are some leaders that you've had in the past, and what made them different? What made them stand out?
Yeah. I mean, the Tall Ferns program has been very fortunate to have some amazing people lead the program, and not just the players who have the C next to their name and other captains. I mean, I go back and I think one of the things that we've always tried to do during my time at the Tall Ferns is really make heroes out of our women's players. And, you know, I think sometimes we're guilty, or sometimes past coaches have maybe been guilty of making heroes out of other players internationally, you know, or idolising a Lauren Jackson, or idolising a Dinah Taurasi. And, I mean, that's great. Or Sue Bird or someone, that's great to idolise them. But, you know, New Zealand needs its own heroes. And if I can go back as far as I can remember, just with the Tall Ferns from when I really first started watching international basketball, and I think of the Sydney Olympics and Athens, and I think of, you know, we've had some great leaders, Leanne Walkers, the Farmer Sisters, and Megan Compayne, you know, even prior to that, you know, your Carolyn Grays. And so we've had some extremely great leaders within New Zealand basketball, and I think it's always great to always acknowledge their contribution to basketball and what they've done. But certainly during my time, look, really hard to go past. One that stands out for me, first of all, would be Kate McMeekin Rusko. And, you know, I was fortunate enough, she was with the Tall Ferns program up until my 2012 year. For me, what made her stand out, first of all, was her work ethic. You know, she was always the hardest. I mean, they were all really hard workers. So, I mean, please, if any of them are listening, I know you're all hard workers, but Kate for me was excellent, you know, with her work ethic on the floor. Her communication was fantastic. You know, her ability to build relationships with all players in the team and take our younger, most inexperienced players under her wing. Her ability to take care of people. She looked like a hard ass on the outside, but on the inside, she was one of the most softest, kindest people you would ever meet. And she was great because she just had great communication skills, and she was very open and transparent with us coaches, particularly me in my earlier years. I could always rely on her to get things done with the team. She was big on her recovery. She worked just as hard on the floor and off the floor. In the gym, she was one of the hardest workers. She was always finding ways to improve herself. And even to her last tour with the Tall Ferns, you know, she was always finding ways to get better and always seeking advice and always seeking improvement. And to me, I think that's a real trademark of a great leader, in that they never rest on their laurels. And for me, Kate was great, and Kate would make big shots. You know, that was another part about Kate's game. I remember playing Mali at the 2008 Olympics, and we needed to make some big shots. And she hit some car park threes for us, two really big shots late in the game that we needed. And she did the same for us in the win against Japan. In Japan, she got a huge offensive rebound and put back. And then she made a really big three late in the game as well. And it's great to be able to have players like that in your team that you can go to at any time and say, this is what we need. Here's what we're going to run. We're looking for you for this shot in this situation, and have players that have the courage and the ability to knock those shots down. So for me, Kate was he an unbelievable leader in a number of different areas, but those are what really stick out for me is her ability to build relationships, her kindness, her ability to lead and work with younger athletes, her ability to knock down big shots, and you know, obviously her work ethic was second to none. That's one. The other I probably would pull up in the later years, obviously, of my time for the program would be Natalie Purcell, or Taylor, these days, and almost for the same reasons. Natalie has this mana that she just has this way of capturing everyone within the team, staff and players included, and just had a way of you know, when she talks, people just listen. You know, you know the sorts of people, like your Mika Vakonas, for when they talk, you just listen. You don't say nothing. You make eye contact and you listen. And Natalie had that with our group, that she'd say things and people would follow her. And that's a really important trait to have as a leader too, is that when you say something, first of all, you live what you're saying and your actions speak louder than your words. And for her, she was similar to Kate in all those respects. Her work ethic was great. Her versatility on the floor, she was able to defend a number of positions and she could knock down some big shots. And, you know, her communication skills were great. Her IQ, basketball IQ, was extremely high. You know, but she was just great to work with. And I guess a lot of those leaders are just, they were easy to deal with. And you know what? Sometimes as coaches, our messages can be very, you know, fuzzy to players. But she had a great way of being able to communicate or regurgitate what I've said and put it into a sentence that the players understood. And then they just go out and get stuff done. And so for me, Natalie's always just been one of those players. And, you know, she had to grow into that role. You know, it was her first time as captain when I think 2000 and I believe might have been 15 or... The 15 first Oceania series where she captained the team, and it was her first captaincy, and the players voted that in. Obviously, we had a voting system that we used for the Tall Ferns to make these things happen, and then we obviously had leadership group. But look, there are too many great leaders, and different everyone. There was a different leader for every situation in our team, and you know I probably missed some out, but I guess I don't want to be talking forever on the subject. But those are two that really stick out for me, two really great leaders in our program for the time that I'd been there.
Cool. And in terms of the future, Kitty, what do you see in the future for the Tall Ferns in terms of players, maybe coaches if you want to speak on it, support? I know that we talked a little bit about some of the players coming up, but is there anything that kind of sticks out to you that you're like, yeah, they'll be in safe hands because of this, and this?
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, the one name that's getting thrown around in New Zealand right now, when I mean, she recently came into camp with us, is Charlize Legan Walker. I mean, she is, yeah, she's something else. You know, she's a great kid. I mean, if I'm going to talk about players, she's certainly one that I think definitely has a future. And obviously, the fact that we're looking at her at such a young age is a real credit to her, and obviously to any of her former coaches. I know Corb's obviously working with her at Waikato, and obviously I know Leanne would. I'm sure, you know, you have that basketball pedigree if your mum's been to, you know, a couple of Olympics. It's always going to help as well. But and obviously having the older sister, Crystal Lega Walker, is another one that you can say, you know, she's going to be a Tall Fan. She already has been in 2014 officially. And then obviously has been an incumbent part of our trialing group. You've got, I mean, goodness, coming out of college now at Seattle, you've got Jacinta Beckley, she's in her senior year. Got Stella Beckett, who's the captain at St. Mary's. Tessa Boagney at Cal State Northridge, that will be graduating soon. You've got Penina Davidson at Cal Berkeley, playing in the Pac-12. That's, again, going to be another great player. I've got a young kid by the name of Drew Tuliafour, who's at Santa Clara. Brooke Blair at Idaho State in the Big Sky. So, I mean, there are a lot of – Mary Gording at Fordham. Obviously, the name escaped. Zara Gillings at Fordham as well. I mean, so there are some serious kids right now. Caitlin Neuer at Fresno. So all those kids were in the college program, and that's not even obviously. I know Crystal's at Northern Colorado, and so is young Tiana Clark. I mean, I really like her. I've enjoyed watching her development. Shelley Solomon at BYU. So there are some, and Tara Reid even, you know, I know Mum was on the show recently at VCU. So look, the New Zealand basketball program is in very good hands. And I mean, I'm only naming, that's probably 10 of 45 other kids we could name. So the next coach is going to have a good problem, but it is a problem as a selection issue with how many of these kids can I bring into the Tall Ferns program. One of our biggest barriers was always trying to work with the college programs and work around their academic schedule. Sometimes we just wouldn't have players involved. We couldn't have players involved because their academic schedule was too busy, so we couldn't bring them into the program.
Kennedy, so speaking on like the trial process, like moving forward, like from an international, like I had Alex Stojkovic on the podcast, the very first episode, and we talked around drills for a representative level. But what is a Tall Ferns, not even just a Tall Ferns, even WNBL, what is the process that goes into having an effective trial at a high international level to get the best team, I suppose?
Yeah, it's well, I mean, definitely, there's definitely two differences between WNBL, for example, when I was head coach at West Coast Waves versus the Tall Ferns program. At WNBL level, I mean, with West Coast, it's slightly different. I mean, I didn't have a big budget, so I could only really recruit in-state players. But at WNBL level, in a professional league, you recruit who you want. Maybe you recruit the sort of players that fit your system, or maybe you recruit the character of the sort of people you'd like to have involved in your program. Certainly for us at the Tall Ferns, while I was involved, it was, you know, we put a really high value or premium on the character of the person, not just the skill. So we actually selected on 5 criteria. One was your character. What are your communication skills like, your leadership skills? Do you have great attitude, or you're selfish or unselfish? Do you have great work ethic or honesty? So all those things, character-wise, that you would look for a person. Do you have great time management? We placed a really high value on. The next thing we looked at out of the 5 areas was physical attributes. Obviously, you know, speed and quickness. Were they slow? They have great fitness, poor fitness, change of speed. So we looked at a number of are they just a phenomenal athlete? So we looked at a number of those areas. We also looked at, obviously, the basketball skills. You know, if you couldn't catch well, you probably need to play underwater hockey or something and consider not a basketball career, or consider coaching like I did. So we looked at, obviously, basketball skills, and, you know, there were specific skills to each position on the floor, you know, obviously. So, I mean, if you reel off, you know, the ability to shoot, create a shot for themselves, their passing technique, the ability to finish in a number of different ways at the rim, whether it be floaters, pull-ups, you know, reverse layups. So we looked at a number. Can they set great screens? The last two, we looked at their basketball IQ. You know, we always were making notes on, you know, did the players understand the difference between, you know, good tempo versus poor tempo, or good shot selection versus poor shot selection, or could they read the oppositional play, and do they pick up offense quickly? Could they scout teams, or could they make adjustments in their game really quickly? So if a defender does this, can they make the next read and do that effectively? You know, obviously, did they have a high level of understanding of their teammates' strengths and weaknesses? Did they have the ability to self-evaluate what was happening on the floor? So we're always, you know, and some, you can, of course, you can't. Some of those things you can see, okay, well, that player can't remember a simple pick and roll offense, or that player can't. So you do see those things very quickly, or that player shot 2 or 3 poor shots, or 2 or 3 great shots in a row. So you do pick those things up, you know, from watching. And then the last one we actually looked at was just their mental skills, you know, their decision making ability. How do they respond to feedback? You know, and of course, as a coach, you know, sometimes I would obviously lose it, as we all do. And certainly at a higher level, the expectation is really high. So, you know, I would always be interested to see how players respond if I was to, you know, to speak to them very firmly, or how would they respond if one of their teammates said, had said something. So their resilience was always obviously, you know, under the microscope, their self-talk, you know, players that miss a layup and then they drop their shoulders and it takes them 2 or 3 seconds to snap into the next phase of the game were always things that we were obviously making note of. So those are the five areas that we'd look at very intensely, and that actually gave us the probably all the feedback we needed, that when we sat down with players individually, we'd give them feedback. But in the whole scope, I mean, it was always difficult because I think I have over 80 players, or I had over 80 players on my radar, and that's from college to WNBL to State League players to WBC players and European-based players. So essentially we had five areas of players that we were always looking at, and sometimes our funds would only allow us to bring in 20, 25. I think the most I ever bought into a camp was 40, and that was one of my very first camps, and we, you know, we were able to bring in a number of different athletes, and that was great for us to be able to bring so many players into that, into the environment. But for us, you know, normally it's a one week selection camp. We're on court 2 to 3 times a day. We're doing video review every night. So there's always team meeting with video review. You know, we have our introduction to camp. You know, we sit down and say, look, you know, here are the expectations. Here are our standards of play. Here's what the camp's going to look like. Here's our schedule. Here's our structure. So the players always sort of knew exactly what was going on. We had a really great team of staff that, you know, made sure every camp went really smoothly. But, you know, certainly the selection process part, you know, the majority of it was done on court, you know. Can they pick these up? And then obviously when you go through video and have individual meetings throughout the camp, players would always sort of know where they're at. You know, look, and I'd be very honest with them and say, look, well, this is where I see you at the moment. Here are some things you're going to need to be able to do to be able to prove to us that you're going to be, you know, I guess here are some things that would put you in the best position to get yourself selected. You know, we need to see evidence of this, this, and this throughout the rest of the camp. And then obviously we get to the last day. And normally the last day we'd almost spend half the day talking to athletes, because it's really important you give them the time and give them the feedback to be able to go away and obviously improve on areas if they didn't quite make the cut. And I think we're really lucky in New Zealand. I think they're a great network of coaches, and a lot of the coaches back home in the WBC and regionally would have contact with me on a regular basis and ask, hey, look, well, what can I do to help X player out to increase their chances? What can we be doing with them to you know, so she has a better chance next time around? And so I think a lot of coaches very proactive in New Zealand, and it's great to see that so many of them now are, you know, I think we're becoming more and more open to sharing ideas with each other. Whereas I remember when I first came up in New Zealand and I was coaching Cross Skills High School, it was very much closed doors. You know, coaches weren't prepared to share anything, and it was, oh, this is my special offense and I don't want to share it because no one else is doing it. Well, you know what? I'm glad all of us as coaches, myself included, we've got over ourselves now and we're starting to share information, because that's what we need to make the game grow and to make it better.
Yeah. And one of the things, and I, when doing notes up for this podcast, Kennedy, I was like, I have to ask you around your uses of your uses of timeouts, because, you know, I'm very similar to you. I observe and I think, okay, what can I take out of here that can form some kind of great habits or something with me? When I watch your timeouts, and I've watched a lot of your games, when I watch your timeouts, I'm very interested to get into your mindset around what exactly you go on, because you're very calm. You're very just, here are the facts, everyone, get it done. But what, speak to us around like emotions and strategies to get, you know, things on task and everything in a timeout. Cause I'd love to get inside of your head with this.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm glad you saw the ones where I was cool, calm and collected. Because maybe some of the others never got televised, which is probably not a good thing. Look, I'm very much, I guess, as I've gotten more experience with my time in coaching, there's less and less emotion. And I guess that's one thing where when I was a younger coach, I did get caught up in a lot of the emotion and sometimes coming to a timeout with little to no focus. Certainly not at the international level, but you know, I'm talking my very early days. You know, someone would miss the layup, and I'd call a timeout for something as you know, stupid as that when I was younger. At international level, I mean, the use of timeouts, I mean, I use them for a number of reasons. One, in the first instance I'm using a timeout would be if we, you know, maybe a team's gone on a run. It's an 8-0 run. Normally I have a rule with, and it could be less than 8-0. But if we get an 8-0 run, I'm calling a timeout straight away. If we gave up two uncontested shots in a row in transition, I'm calling a timeout. I mean, anything to help shift momentum or stop momentum, I'd be using my timeouts for those reasons. Look, sometimes if you're in a position where you've got a team of five players that are working really well, I've used timeouts just to give them a break. And I mean, look, you can get really punished for doing that internationally. You have to really be in a good position, both ends of the floor, to be able to utilize your timeouts like that. But I have known people to use them for those reasons. Within the timeout itself, you know, look, I guess I'm always, we have some basic goals or have a game process we try to follow. And part of it is we know that if we're doing our job on the floor offensively and defensively, we're going to force the other team into timeouts. And that for us is a chance to celebrate, you know, not celebrate, but small successes. You know, you've got to try to find ways to win that aren't necessarily on the scoreboard sometimes. So I know if other coaches are calling timeouts, they're in a position where we're in a position where we're doing something really well and they need to make an adjustment. So we look at it from the other end too. We go, great, they call a timeout. Here's a chance for us to maybe change something to counter what they're going to do. So within the timeout itself, I'll try to keep things really simple now. You know, I used to come into the timeout and think it was my chance to sweat beads of knowledge onto my players and talk about, you know, everything. Whereas now I'm just thinking, okay, well, let's talk about the next offense and the next defense, or what's the purpose of my timeout? Why have I called it? Okay, well, I've called it because they're killing us in this area here, whether it be an offensive transition, whether this action here is hurting us. Well, let's make sure we address the action. And I guess another area where, I'm sure a lot of coaches will relate to this, is we come into timeout sometimes as coaches and all we talk about is the problems. Oh, they're killing us on the mid-ball screen and they're killing us on offensive rebounds, but we don't actually give any solution. So I actually believe coming to your timeout and making sure, hey, here are the problems, here are the solutions, let's go and get it done now. And I normally keep it to one or two messages, maybe sometimes three. It might just be some positive reinforcement to each player. Hey, you know, great job. And now on this, keep going there. Tony, I want you to keep doing this. Michaela, great job. Okay, offensively right now, our next play is this. They're defending us this way. We're going to look at this action here. Let's see what we get out of it. Defensively, you know, we've just been playing man that's had some success. You know, now they're going to make some adjustments. And, hey, next defense, we'll stay zone until they score. And that would be the majority of the time out. You know, hands in, let's go and get it done. So very simplistic timeouts. But I think for coaches out there, you know, I'm sure all of you can find the problems and you can address, you know, but give solutions. You know, that is the – that's so important, because I think sometimes we go on and we're so angry and we lose focus. Well, oh, you know, blimmin' heck, Charlie Sliger Walker scored 60 points. You know, what are you doing on defense? You know, well, the kid already feels bad enough. How about give us some solutions? Well, we're going to double their next catch and we're going to get the ball out of our hands. So solutions are really key in timeouts.
So what's your ratios between positive things that you say in a timeout to negative, or not negative, but those, you know, those bringing up issues, I suppose.
Yeah. Oh, look, I mean, you got to call a spade sometimes. If in look, I mean, at international level, you know, I mean, we're lucky enough to be dealing with elite women. They can handle it. You know, if you know, you certainly do have to pick your moments as a coach. But I mean, look, for me, it depends. If I'm addressing a team, you know, I think always some of the things you've done well, constructive criticism, and then finish with a couple of positives can always be, you know, particularly for junior coaches, for any of them who are listening, you know, I think it's important that players, you almost want to reinforce more of the positive behavior and the things you want to have happen on the floor versus the things you don't want to have happening. If all you're ever talking about is what you don't want to have happen on the floor, that's probably all you're ever going to see as a coach. And if that's all you're ever reinforcing as a coach, well, that's all your players are ever going to hear. So I certainly think addressing the positive things and things that teams are doing well, reinforcing those things are really important as a coach. But in timeouts, I mean, look, if, again, I guess the tone and the way you address those things can change things dramatically, you know. You know, if you have a sense of urgency in your voice, if, you know, if I'm using this tone now versus, you know, well, you know, and it's a very directive tone at somebody and you're pointing fingers and your body language can say a lot as well as a coach. So I think you just got to be pretty mindful of those things. But I'm always trying to, I guess, be calm and collected, because in timeout situations, particularly late games, is the players will feed off you as a coach. And if you're showing anxiety and disorganization, or if you have doubt in your mind, players are smart. They pick that stuff up, you know, particularly at international level. They're smart. Other teams can feed off your energy too. So I think having a very calculated and, you know, calm mindset can help. But, of course, you know, I've definitely had timeouts where it's probably lucky the camera hasn't been there to pick up some of the stuff I've said.
Yeah. All right. So, Kennedy, we're going into we do this every podcast. We go into our realist rounds. We're going to get a couple of questions. Just take your time. You can answer them as long or as short as you want to, and we'll go from there. Are you ready?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Here we go. Most craftiest defender you've ever coached?
Oh, craftiest defender I've ever coached. I'll keep it New Zealand specific. I'm going to go – oh, I've got too many to choose from, to be honest. You know what? I'm going to say like a Stella Beck was great for us in a couple of tours. She's a very crafty defender and can defend multiple positions. But then at the same time, look, yeah, I'm going to go with her as one of them. And then maybe an Antonia Edmondson's been a great defender too for us. But actually, you know what? No, the top of the mountain, actually I've got it, is Anika Kerr. Anika Kerr is the craftiest defender. She's the craftiest defender New Zealand's had while I've been involved. You know, we're talking about a 6-foot player that is she's now Anika Davis, who was just able to get in people's heads. And I'll have to post at some stage, but I've got this – the most best battle of her defending Lisa Leslie at the 2008 Olympics, and Anika was all up in her grill, all in her head, and it was great. But in fact, Lauren Jackson hated playing against Anika Kerr. So there you go. That to me tells me that she was probably one of our best and craftiest defenders.
And coached against? Is there any player you coached against and you're like, man, she takes away all offense from X amount of player?
Yeah, look, there are a lot. There are a lot of great defenders and that, you know, ones I'd consider elite defenders in the world. Oh, goodness. Just to throw a name out there, I guess. Oh, Eva Vitakova. No one would know who she is. Look her up. She probably doesn't even play in the national team anymore. She's from the Czech Republic. The Czech's smallest player was about 6 foot. And so that was their point guard. Their two guard was 6'5". Their three guard was 6'6". Their four man was 6'10", Berger over, and their center was about 6'10" as well. So Vitakova could defend every position. I think she was, she was 6'5", very mobile, very long, and you weren't getting any easy shots over her. And yeah, she's probably, I mean, look, just one to throw out was a great defender. So, yeah, the Czech Republic women's team.
Cool. So after a loss, after you lose a game, what's the first thing you look for in the box score and why?
Good question. You know what? I think it probably would change every game. But I normally look at shooting percentage. Shooting percentage is probably the first one I look at, because to me that reinforces whether we were getting – I certainly believe if we're getting great shots – we're generally shooting a higher percentage. If we're shooting poor shots or being rushed into quick shots or shooting contested shots, I believe the percentage is going to be low. So I'm sort of looking down the column there to see who shot the ball well. But, I mean, of course, as a coach, you keep track of all these things throughout the game.
It's very interesting you say that. A lot of coaches will go straight to the turnovers or they'll go straight to the rebounding stats, but that's a very interesting take on that. I never thought about that. That's so good.
I mean, yeah. I look at the turnovers. Anyway,
no, you go. Sorry.
No, I was just saying, I'd look at everything. So, but yeah, that for one, because we place a high premium on the ability to shoot uncontested shots, you know, that's something we'd look at.
All right, when you're back home, Kennedy, you go to that bakery, what's that pie that you're getting? What's that pie? You know, I haven't had one of these for a while. I need to get this pie. What is it?
Oh, it's Copeland's Bakery, the bacon and egg pie.
Oh, there we go. Shout outs to Copeland's Bakery. New sponsors of the podcast.
Yeah, you guys need to get on board.
So no pies in Australia, I'm guessing?
Oh, man. I used to love fish and chips, but I have fish and chips once a year here. I'd have it once a week when I was living in New Zealand. They just don't know how to, like, I mean, in New Zealand, $5 where I'm from would feed the neighborhood. You know, you go to Big Gary's and go down to Big Gary's by Cal Stadium in Christchurch. You get yourself a big dog. You get yourself $4 worth of chips. So you get a dollar loaf of bread, you know, one of those Copeland dollar loaf of bread. You get some sauce and maybe a creaming soda and you'd have a feast. You know, you and the guys after training would have a feast.
Yeah.
Whereas in Australia, that's $50. If you want to have that feast and feed the boys, that's $50. So, you know, I definitely, there's no pies or anything like that here that I like. I have to wait till I get home.
Man, fish and chips. I have to try this big dog. What's this big dog thing you speak of?
Oh, I think it's about $2 these days if you go to Big Gary's down there. And I mean, when I was at Aranui, because I went to Aranui High School for a year at the academy with Bert and us guys after every training. And when it was terrible nutrition. The nutrition science just wasn't out there back then. And maybe if I'd not eaten, you know, two big dogs a day, I probably would have been a much better basketball player. But yeah, you got to go down there, try it. Big Gary's big dog. And, yeah, Big Gary will sort you out. He'll definitely sort you out. It's on Pages Road, Christchurch, New Zealand. Get down and see Big Gary.
Pages Road. Anybody out there, they want to get a good feed, go to Pages Road, Big Gary's. Shout outs to Gary. All right, next question. Mount Rushmore, and I always do the Mount Rushmore, for the best. So Mount Rushmore of tall Ferns guards that you've coached over your tenure.
Yeah, perfect. Okay, well... Look, I guess the first one I'll start with would definitely be Michaela Cox. You know, her longevity in the program, for one, her ability to stay in incredible shape. She's someone who is just in an amazing, an immaculate shape all the time. Any fitness test that all friends do, she's winning by three or four levels. You go to the beep test and the next best person gets 14, well, Michaela will get level 17. You know, that's the sort of mindset and work ethic and determination she has. So she's definitely up there for me. Other guards that I would talk about that retired during my time is Noni Whareamate, now Noni Martin. You know, for me, she was great because her passing ability was just unbelievable, and her ability to create for others, and she was very unselfish, but she was also a very good defender. In fact, she'd be on my top list as well. Just her long arms. I reckon she had about a 6'2" wingspan on a 5'8" body. But her creativity and ability to create for others was just second to none. So those are two. And then probably the last one, if I was to go three, would be, again, Antoni Edmondson, because, you know, I saw her journey from a 16-year-old, extremely athletic, wiry, you know, Caucasian kid from Christchurch, you know, that into a, I mean, she's developed into a full-time professional now, playing in the WNBL in Australia. She's with Perth at the moment. It's just come back from injury, but her journey has been, you know, a great one, because she was part of that 2008 team that missed out. She missed out on going to the Olympics, and you know, I know how hard that was for her on missing out, and it was a very big knock for her. But to see her resurgence from, you know, missing out, and the resilience she's shown now to be a permanent player in our Tall Ferns program and a captain at that and a great leader as well has been, you know, unbelievable. So she's up there as well.
Yeah. And then Biggs,
Mount Rushmore of New Zealand swings or bigs or whatever you want to, or you can put whoever you want on here. Four of the best that you've had.
Four of the best. Okay. At number one, I'm going to go, or Gillian Hartman's the first one we go to right now. I mean, she's an international superstar. You know, she gets the biggest. Her head gets chiselled out the biggest on the Mount Rushmore because I just think the amount of time she's put our team on her shoulders herself, and just said, "Hey, ladies, you know, I'm going to take this game over and do everything I need to do." Her game's similar to a Paul Pierce. She's got that awesome little mid-range jumper at the elbow. And I remember Paul Pierce just absolutely icing people, and that's. We used to say she'd make that jumper and, you know, Ake or me and one of the coaches would turn to each other and say, Paul Pierce, you know, when she'd make that shot in the middle of the game, you know, because she's just cool as ice with that stuff. But her ability to create in the low post and her little fall-away jumper and her spin moves and her defensive ability and her ability to create and transition and handle the ball is what separates her from others. And her incredibly high basketball IQ as well is just great. So she's the top for me. Next would be Lisa Warburton. Again, and I'm only talking about the time I've been involved in the program. Of course, there were many greats prior to myself. She was great because Lisa at a number of events was always in the top 10 for rebounders, and as a 6 foot guard, a 6 foot post player. You know, she had an incredible nose for the ball. At the 2008 Olympics, she was one of the top 10 rebounders. You know, she had an incredible ability to shoot the ball. I mean, if you ever wanted someone to rebound for, I'd always say I'll rebound for Lisa because all I ever do is stand underneath the net and just catch the ball as it came out through the net and then spit it back out to her. Incredible shooter and an incredibly nice person too. I mean, she's just one of the nicest human beings you ever come across. But one of the toughest human beings you're ever going to play against. So it was great how she had those polar opposites. Once she got inside that rectangle, it was on. So there's two. At three, I'm going to probably put Charmian Mellers now, or Charmian Purcell as a forward. You know, as tough as they come. And I remember sometimes where I'd have to, when I was with the Christchurch Sirens, if I ever had to get on the floor, I wouldn't want to have to defend her because you're going to get elbows, you're going to get knocked around, she's going to hit you. And, you know, I swear that, you know, I went home pretty sore sometimes just having to work out individually with her or have to, you know, defend her. But, you know, her level of intensity and hustle and athleticism was great. You know, there were no rests and she was just relentless in everything she did on the floor. So that's three. And you know what? A kid that's coming up right now and I believe is going to be, you know, a great tall fan is Penina Davidson. You know, I remember watching her as a 14-year-old kid coming through basketball. And, you know, she's really – the last couple of tours she's been on with us, she's really solidified herself as a starting international forward. And she has a lot of upside and has incredible agility for such a, you know, she's not huge, but a tall player can honestly defend in the half court, any position on the floor with her mobility, but also her defensive tenacity. I mean, you know, being able to stop players like Sandrea Gruda, who's an international superstar from France in that last Olympic qualifying event, just absolutely made her look stupid the first two plays. Penina blocked her shot, sent it straight back down into her face. Excuse me, twice in a row. So, well, Penina's definitely up there for me as well.
Cool. Funny story that you bring up, Charmian. Charmian was actually, when I was at school, because I went to James Cook High School, shout out to James Cook in Manurewa. Charmian, she did her teacher, because she was training to be a teacher, she did her teaching practicum. Yeah. And I was year 13 at the time, and we already had a coach. He wasn't even a good coach. He was just a volleyball guy. We had a good team. We won counties. We thought we were all that. She comes to the gym. She's like, oh, I'll take you guys for a training session. We had no clue who she was. She came in, and then we were running like a layup drill, like a one-on-one stuff, and she was saying, yeah, do this, do this. And one of the boys just got a bow to the face and started bleeding. And she was like, ah. Just go put some water on it. You'll be fine. That was, and then, yeah, and then from then we're like, yeah, she's pretty good. And then she would just scrimmage with us and beat the crap out of us.
Yeah, yeah, that definitely sounds like the Charmian. And you know what? Funny enough, she's still playing in the Queensland Basketball League here now, and she's still posting, you know, double doubles every game. You know, 15 rebounds, 15 points. It's yeah, she's still killing it over here.
Anyway, man, were you a Sega kid growing up, or were you a Nintendo kid growing up? Which one were you?
I was the Sega, man, because that was the least expensive one for the family, you know. So money was tight. But I mean, we're talking first world problems here. I still had a Sega, so but Sega.
You had that that Alex the Kid, like every other kid did.
Yeah, that's the one game that came with the console, man. That was it. And if I was lucky, you know, dad might give me $2 and I can go and hire a game, a Street Fighter 2 or something, or Road Rage or Streets of Rage or something like that if I was really lucky.
All right. Mount Rushmore of Canterbury players in the 90s or 2000s. Oh.
Oh, yep. Well, for me, if I was to say, like, my idols as a kid, Clifton Bush, the Super Bush. You know, he's up there for me. I used to love it when he'd dunk on people and, you know, just show them the thumb and the index finger and tell them they're too small. That for me was definitely big time. Another couple of names that don't get thrown around too often, Jason Kyle. He was big time for me, you know, growing up. I used to love watching him play. Carlo Verrocchio, I don't even know if he's even in New Zealand still. I don't know what he's up to these days. He was an amazing guard. I mean, Rui Manahi. Like, so if I'm talking about men's players, that they definitely all spring to mind for me in the 90s. Women's players, I mean, we were lucky enough to have Megan Compayne come and play for the Canterbury Wildcats 1 year, along with another – oh, goodness. We had an Irish import. And I forget her name now. And funny enough, I have an Irish import in my team now. We talk about her all the time, but the name escapes me. Obviously, the Farmer Sisters, they're up there for me. Obviously, watching them play when Phil was coaching the Wildcats back sometime. I mean, so they're definitely just some names out there that I can certainly throw out just off the cusp that are probably, you know, those early 90s to late 2000s type players that we were lucky enough to have play in the Canterbury region.
Cool. You've got one player, or any player that you've coached, you're down one, no more time on the clock, two free throws. Who are you going?
For foul shots?
Foul shots.
I'm going Michaela Cox.
You know she's going to make
it. Michaela Cox.
Michaela Cox, yep. Easy. Yep, just relentless, just clutch. She just makes them.
Oh, I just know how much time she puts into practicing them, and I know how competitive she is. So yeah, if the game's on the line, we're gonna make two foul shots. Michaela Cox is getting the call up.
All right, so I'm gonna hit you with three questions now, Kennedy, and these are like psychological questions for 90s kids. I know that you're 80s kids, 90s kids. First one. This is, you got to think about this one. Are you a Stockton and Malone guy, or are you a Kemp and Payton guy?
Oh, I'm probably going to go Kemp and Payton. One, because I'm a Supersonics fan, and now I follow OKC. Obviously, when the license has changed over, I was more into the high flying, you know, alley oops that Kemp and Payton used to produce versus the. You know, I mean, Stockton and Malone were awesome off the pick and roll, and they were very fundamental with the way they played. But I love Kemp's. It was a different sort of intensity as a post player. There was more flair to the game, and I guess that attracted me more than that. Whereas now, if I was to pick it now, honestly, if I was in the 90s, it's Kemp and Payton. If I was to pick it now, I'm going to go more fundamental. I'm going to go Stockton and Malone. So it's interesting how my mindset's changed over time, and it's probably correlates really well with my lack of athleticism these days that I'm thinking, okay, the fundamental pull-up jump shot or give it to the big man on the low block is more attractive to me that now than to what when I was 17 years old. I'm like, yeah, man, I'm going to try and dunk this on this guy. And that was my mentality back then. So it's funny how coaching's changed that.
The Kemp and Payton are my go-to when the NBA Jam gets kicked out. And I'm like, oh, yep, this is what we're going to – they're my two. Because there's no Jordan back in that game, so it was like, you know, if it was Jordan Pippen, might be a little bit different.
Yeah, yeah, probably the same for me too. NBA Jam and it definitely. But yeah, I was definitely Peyton and Kemp. And if I needed threes, I'd go Detlef Schrempf and Kemp.
Oh, there we go. All right, best star, Jean-Claude Van Damme, Bloodsport or Kickboxer?
Yeah, for me, this one's simple. It's Kickboxer because I like the way ZN used to coach him, you know, for all the trees and the pulling of the pulleys and stretching the legs. And I like that intense style of coaching. And, you know, so I was and then he has to kick the palm tree, Whittle palm tree, and he's kicking the tree away and then he just grabs on his legs. So I really like that. I thought it was good. But there's one that I think trumps both of them, and I don't know if anyone's ever seen it. It's called the King of the Kickboxers.
Ooh.
And that's real old school. So if you haven't seen that one, check out The King of the Kickboxers. And me and my younger sister used to quote that movie like crazy. So it was funny growing up.
Oh man, the best thing on I'm a kickboxer. Oh, Bloodsport was pretty good, but Kickboxer when he gets drunk and starts dancing, that's the best meme on the internet ever.
That's right. Yeah, in fact, I think one of those shows recently, they got him out there to do the same dance again. He could still do it. So yeah, Van Damme was the man back in the day for sure.
And when you're back home, is it a hangi or is it a boil up? Which one out of these two?
Oh, I mean, I definitely prefer hangi, but you know the problem is, you know, you can't always, those things only come around every now and then. So the boil up's certainly the more convenient and the most cheapest, you know. But I definitely prefer hangi. But I know what I'm going to get if I go see my sister or, you know, back home. I'm probably going to get the boil up first because that's, you know, that's just the most convenient and the cheapest for most. But yeah, both are good. As long as you have a good loaf of bread to eat it with, it's all good.
Well, when you come back to New Zealand, I've got to take you to some spots, man. We got hangi shops now. We got hangi and boil up shops in New Zealand now.
Oh, what? I didn't know that. All I knew it was dumplings, $2 rice in Christchurch. Oh. That's normally the spot with. If I'm going back home, but that sounds awesome. I'm glad to see the someone out there is capitalizing on the great food.
Oh, jeez. All right, and last one I'm going to ask you, Kennedy, for our great talk. What's the best piece of advice coaching advice that anybody's ever given you?
Wow! Oh, goodness. It's, you know, funny enough, The one piece that really resonates with me is one that was actually used in the last podcast. So I feel like I can't use that one, but you know, I'm going to anyway. And it's, I've heard the same thing that players don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And I think that's building relationships with your players and you know, I think basketball it's bigger than just the sport itself. I think the best coaches do. They find time to ask people about their day and how they've been and what's going on in their lives. And you know, so I definitely believe in that. I guess to reference some of that stuff and for anyone who has time and is willing to, you know, if they want to educate themselves and better themselves as coaches, a really great book to read is called How to Build and Sustain a Championship Culture. And it was written by a coach named Jeff Jansen.
Okay.
And anyone who ever wants to learn about how to create, you know, how to implement credible leaders and how to create a value system and how to, you know, and learn about the different types of cultures, the 8 different types of cultures that can either be currently existing or, you know, then obviously the ideal culture you want. That's a great book to read. And I think if that's, I was lucky enough, a coach here in Australia, his name is Ben Ettridge, gave me that. He was the past Australian rollers coach, which is the Australian wheelchair team. And he coached a couple of gold medals at the Paralympics and World Championships. And that's actually a book that he presented to me and I read through it and I thought it was absolute basketball gold. So that was, I guess it wasn't advice, but it was certainly you know, that was a great thing. Probably another great piece of advice was just always be honest and transparent with your players because, you know, they know when you're telling them when you're giving them BS, they know they're smart. So always be honest with your players and be honest with yourself and your own self-evaluation.
Cool.
And and also take every opportunity you get, you know, because again, I wouldn't be in the position or have been blessed to have been doing all the things I've done if I hadn't have, you know, taken every opportunity that was thrown in front of me.
Great. Yeah. So thank you so much, Kennedy. And like, firstly, thanks for the podcast and coming on, but thank you for the 10 year that you've had from 2008 all the way to now with females or with women's basketball, and also just, you know, like setting the standard and setting a place where young girls can reach towards. I mean, I've I know Jordan Hunter's through, I mean, I was coaching when she was coming up in their age groups through Counties Monaco, and to see her get to that level and aspire to that when, you know, it was there, but it kind of wasn't before. And I just think, you know, like, I'm just really thankful that for somebody, and not just Jordan, but other young women that are coming up in the game, they have something to reach for. So thank you so much, man.
No, look, thank you. And look, thanks to the whole Basketball New Zealand community. It's been an incredible ride, and I'm not going anywhere. I live in Australia now, and I get home and I'm always more than happy to share any content I have. It's knowledge that's been given to me free of charge by some great coaches, and I'm prepared to give it back for nothing. That's part of it. So no, look, I really appreciate what you're doing too. I love the podcast. I'm going to continue to listen in. I'm not going to listen to my own one because I don't want to hear my own voice, but I certainly will be listening the rest of the podcast you put out. And if any potential sponsors out there listening, please help Tim you know, continue this great thing he's doing for all of our coaches in New Zealand and now internationally. I believe you've got a few international coaches listening in now, so if Facebook unblock me, I'll start inviting more people.
Oh man, but no, it's been a pleasure to get to know you as well. You know, I've talked to you a couple of times, but it's great to really understand who you are as a coach and as a person, and it's been great. And I'd love to have you back on and not talk too much about the TOFA and stuff, but a lot of the intricacies with basketball coaching. I'd love to have you back on.
I'm more than happy to come on anytime at all.
Cool. All right. Thank you, Kennedy, and thanks so much.